Hello, my name is Elle Wadsworth and welcome to another episode of Addiction Audio, the podcast from the journal Addiction. I'm joined here today with Sammy Back, a master's student at the Centre for Substance Use and Addiction Research at the Erasmus University Rotterdam, and Amesa Krohn, a PhD student in the Department of Psychology at the University of Amsterdam, as well as the Centre for Substance Use and Addiction Research, Erasmus University Rotterdam. They're both here to talk about their and their co-authors' paper titled Does Nitrous Oxide Addiction Exist? An evaluation of the evidence for the presence and prevalence of substance use disorder symptoms in recreational nitrous oxide users. Welcome to the podcast, Sammy and Amesa.
Thank you.
Cute.
So their article is a narrative review evaluating the evidence for the prevalence and presence of the 11 DSM-5 substance use disorder symptoms in nitrous oxide consumers, a topic where there is minimal research and there's no consensus on nitrous oxide's addictive potential. Now, this wasn't intentional, nor will it matter for those listening at home on a different day, but we are currently recording this podcast on November the 8th, 2023, which is also the day that the possession of nitrous oxide, also known as laughing gas, balloons or NOS, becomes illegal in the UK. As of today, nitrous oxide is a Class C substance under the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, meaning that possession results in an unlimited fine, community service, a caution or up to 2 years imprisonment for repeat offenders. Whether or not we agree that the possession of nitrous oxide should be legal or whether the punishment equals its harms is not the focus of the discussion, but the change in legislation here in the UK at least highlights that nitrous oxide's surge in popularity and media attention surrounding it. So, before we get into the paper and findings, for those who don't know what nitrous oxide is or what the hell I've just said, could you briefly start by explaining what it is, its use, how people access it, and maybe the effects?
Yeah, definitely. So nitrous oxide is a compound of nitrogen and oxygen. It was discovered in the 18th century. It's an odorless and colorless gas, and it has been used mostly in anesthetic settings since the 19th century. Apart from that medical application, nitrous oxide is also used in the food industry, used as a propellant. So it's the thing in your whipped cream dispensers that make the cream outcome nice and fluffy. Our paper here focuses mostly on the recreational use of it, so inhaling nitrous oxide for the pleasurable effects. Most inhalers do that by filling balloons, using those whippets from the whipped cream dispensers or larger tanks. In heavy users, we also see the inhalation directly from the tank or even using a face mask connected to a tank to keep you inhaling continuously. Those pleasurable effects when inhaled are characterized by euphoria, more of a relaxation also, and also a hallucinogenic state. It lasts really shortly, so only about a minute, which makes it the inhalant drug with the fastest onset of all inhalants. The access, as you also asked, is relatively easy, although an increasing number of countries are banning the selling or possessing of nitrous oxide specifically for recreational purposes. It's mostly still not a controlled substance yet. So therefore, in many countries, it's still legally and pretty easily available through wholesalers or even some supermarkets or round-the-clock delivery services, which is thought to also contribute to its popularity.
While we're on, I guess, the definitions and getting people up to speed, you also examined the literature according to the DSM-5 criteria. Could you also just briefly explain what we mean by when we say DSM-5?
Yeah, of course. Let me define that then also. The abbreviation stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's developed by the American Psychiatric Association. And what it basically is a manual of all known and researched mental disorders that we have. What it does is to list a certain number of symptoms, also criteria, which have to be met in order to receive a certain diagnosis. In the case of substance use disorder, it lists 11 different criteria, of which individuals who experience two or more are classified as having a mild substance use disorder, four or more as moderate, and six or more as severe.
So let's get into the findings now. So could you start by telling us what the take-home messages from your paper were that you found?
Yes, let me take over. I think most importantly, our review really shows that there is consistent evidence for at least the presence of some DSM-5 symptoms in heavy nitrous oxide users, which kind of indicates that it could well be an addictive substance, and that it's probably important to treat it like that while we gather more evidence on the effects of heavy nitrous oxide use. Mostly also because the research on heavy nitrous oxide use is just really lacking, because we see that there has been an enormous surge in use over the last decade, which was kind of unexpected. And I think we really need to provide a proper source of information for policymakers, but also healthcare professionals, and also the users to really know about the risks that they're taking while using nitrous oxide, just to evaluate on their own. And I think we really need more information on that. And that's also our take-home message. There's really just not enough research out there. Most of our results are based on case studies or reviews of case studies, which really we would just like to encourage researchers to do proper experimental research into nitrous oxide use.
Thank you. I think that's a good take-home message. And you touched on something there, which was that the surge in the last decade has been huge. Do we know why, and why now? It's not exactly a new drug. You just said 18th century, right? It's not new.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Also, because we really honestly have not a very clear idea why this enormous surge has been there. It's easily available. It's really cheap. It has low lift effects, and people, just because of its medical use and its use in the food industry, people also have very low perceived harms associated with use. So I think it's partly related to that. And there was clearly a gap in the market and people jumped on it. And I think also you see it that people started selling those enormous tanks filled with nitrous oxide, which were clearly used for recreational purposes and not any medical or food industry purposes. So I think mostly in the coming years, we will see whether the increased change in policies will actually affect people's perception of harm, especially among young users, which is very common with nitrous oxide, and then see whether that change perception of harm also affects their use. I think that will be most interesting. Yeah.
Your answer actually just touches on my next question, so it might be a repetition. But my question was, why do you think that this is such an important topic to examine now?
Yeah, I think almost 1 in 4 people ever use nitrous oxide, which is an enormous amount of people. And just because of that massive surge, we have very little understanding, because there's no research infrastructure surrounding it. And we really appear to lag behind on the science. And it's really, our review is mostly also a way to open a discussion into the importance of nitrous oxide research and encourage addiction researchers that are not necessarily in the field of nitrous oxide addiction to really take on this topic, to together work on increasing that knowledge.
So as well as the quite high prevalence being 1 in 4 in the lifetime use, you, in your paper, you provide a percentage that 3% of consumers inhale at least once a week. How does this compare to other substances? Is this a high percentage, say, to other substances, maybe cannabis or alcohol, of those that use once a week rather than, say, lifetime or past year?
I think it's relatively high, but because the statistics are so limited, it's really hard to get an accurate estimate. Also, because most of our statistics are based on Western European countries, primarily the UK and the Netherlands, where use is pretty extreme compared to other parts of the world. So if you look at the Netherlands, it's the most common drug after cannabis and MDMA, excluding alcohol and tobacco, which are more common daily use substances. And it is interesting that it shows quite similar patterns of use as cannabis and MDMA. So men use more often, there's adolescent onset, it peaks during young adulthood, but also the vast majority of users, over 90%, are less than monthly users. It's just that, so it seems to be similar to cannabis and MDMA in terms of the statistics. But of course, for us, it's mostly those daily users that inhale more than 10 hits per session that are at higher risk for quite severe negative consequences that are of primary interests to see whether we can inform them better and inform treatment.
You said that the makeup similar to MDMA and cannabis, is the scenarios that people would consume nitrous oxide similar to those scenarios anyway, as in potentially after a night at the club when you would have used MDMA, going home and then potentially using balloons? Is it because there's that similarities in situational use?
Yes, I think it is partially related to the social component that's often related to nitrous oxide use. So most recreational users that do not use on a daily basis use in social settings. It's just that similar with cannabis, those that use heavily are often also the ones that do not use only in social settings. But it is the case that indeed balloons can be bought for like one coin in the Netherlands at a festival. And they've changed that now, but the availability in social settings, which people would otherwise use MDMA, it's quite similar. It is of interest though that I'm not 100% sure, but it's slightly different in terms of the peak of use is very, very young. And you really see this adolescent surge in use. And also because it's easy to use at home, you do not leave any mess, it seems safe. Parents usually don't worry about it that much. So in terms of that, it's quite a different situation.
Yeah, and as you mentioned before, it's quite quick. It's an easy period of time to hide. So in your paper, you found that there's evidence for 4 of the 11 DSM-5 criteria for substance use disorder. Could you talk us through what those 4 criteria are and what you found?
Definitely. So the 4 we found consistent evidence for. The first one is that the substance is often taken in larger amount or over a longer period than expected or intended by the user themselves. Evidence for this criteria is a little bit more diverse. It's a little bit more than for the other ones. For example, one systematic review of case studies suggests that this criteria is present in 46% to 98% of users. So that's quite a considerable part. And then also in separate case studies and one study with a little bit more quantitative design using surveys backs this up. So around half to even more of the users appears to use the substance in larger amounts or longer than they intended. Well, the second one that we found consistent evidence for is that a great deal of time is spent on nitrous oxide. So the official criterion for this also regards the time necessary to obtain the substance, to use it, and to recover from its effects. For nitrous, that's a little bit different because, as we just discussed, the time to recover from it is quite limited, and also the time to get it also appears a little bit less than for other substances because it's pretty easily available. However, most of heavy nitrous oxide users seem to check this box because they spend like a substantial time on using the drug, with binges possibly lasting up to multiple days, even in a row. Let's see, the third one is more of a social criterion. So continued use of the substance despite having interpersonal problems caused or made worse by the drug. There's quite a lot of evidence on this criterion suggesting social or interpersonal problems in 13% to 80% of users, heavy users. Examples of these social problems can be conflict with parents, as a lot of the users are quite young, conflict with other family members or partners or friends, resulting in more social isolation. The last one that we found consistent evidence for is recurrent use of the substance in situations in which it's physically hazardous. Sounds kind of vague, but what we mean is use in situations like while driving. In the case of nitrous oxide, also administration methods that risk asphyxiation, so using the masks. Research on the prevalence of driving under the influence of nitrous oxide is very localized So pretty much all data comes from the Netherlands or Belgium, so that limits it a bit. But those Belgian numbers suggest that up to 6% of the driving populations drive after using nitrous, at least monthly. So we can imagine that under heavy users, this percentage is way higher. Another example for this risky use is inhaling directly from the tank, which I touched upon briefly in the beginning. Most users, or more light users, they use the balloons, but heavy users sometimes inhale directly from those larger tanks, which can cause like extreme barotrauma to the lungs because the pressure in the tanks is so high. And then also up to third degree frostbite injuries, because when nitrous is released, it's really cold. So that's frostbite to the mouth, lips, or other parts of the body touching the tank. So this, for this criteria, also relatively, there's a relatively good amount of evidence. The thing with all criteria that we found consistent evidence for is that, as Amaze also touched upon, evidence is limited. It is mostly from case studies, some reviews. So we also still stress for all these criteria that more systematic or experimental research is necessary. But for those four, we found consistent evidence.
I'm wondering with the driving, because that's another point that was raised, even with the change in regulation today from the UK, that driving under the influence of nitrous oxide is a concern. But I guess logistically for me, I'm just wondering, are those is that from self-report after the fact? I'm just, because it's such a quick thing. Is it taken whilst driving? Or immediately into the car and then driving after? Do we know?
It's a little bit of both. The questionnaire data I was touching upon is a self-report. But we do see that people use while driving, having a tank between their legs while behind the wheel. But also in the Netherlands, I know it's in the Netherlands, not sure about other countries, that a lot of times people are arrested while speeding or driving irresponsibly, and then nitrous tanks are found in the car. So then again, also the effects of nitrous are pretty short-lived, but there has been a research that studied the impairing effects on driving, and that lasted, I think, up to 30-ish minutes. So even getting behind the wheel after inhaling can still be quite dangerous.
Okay, so you've mentioned that the evidence is quite slim, and this may be the reason why the evidence for the other DSM-5 criteria are quite lacking. But could you talk us through the ones that the evidence didn't meet, and are there any that you thought that they would, or that maybe you don't think will anyway? I think we've got tolerance, we've got withdrawal, ones that weren't met. But I guess, is there anything interesting that you found from the ones that the evidence didn't meet the criteria?
I think an interesting thing that I found while researching is that the more pharmacological criteria, so tolerance and withdrawal, didn't meet our standards. So the withdrawal one, there was really insufficient evidence. There's just like, I think, one or two case studies that suggest unpleasurable after effects, but mostly none. And for the tolerance one, it's inconclusive. There is some examples of self-reported tolerance. There's also some users saying things like, okay, we started with 2 kg tanks, but that increased to 8 or 10 because we kept wanting the same result. So that implies tolerance as well. That's just very slim and very limited. While with other substances like alcohol, like cannabis, those are very much evident. There's also, so that was kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, I think for me, the one that stands out is craving, because no, that's one that I actually expect to be there. I just think that the research is really lacking. And I think also there's quite some older research on nitrous oxide use. And also the change from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5 really affected the measurement of craving, which I think is really important to focus on in new studies as well, because craving is one of the better predictors of actually engaging in repeated use, which can end up in an addiction cycle. So I think that's one that really stood out to me. I was expecting more research focusing on craving nitrous oxide, which, yeah, I really hope that we can take that up and also really get systematic evidence for those effects, because that could really impact the escalation of use.
That actually feeds quite well to my final question, because it was looking at what is the next steps regarding research in this area. I think we've touched on it before, that we're wanting that experimental evidence, we're wanting systematic evidence. Is what would be your call out to the research world of what we need?
Yeah, I think the next steps are mostly that we just need more data. We really need more data, because for a drug used this regularly, it's honestly quite astounding that we have so little scientific evidence to inform the public, but also healthcare professionals and policymakers. Because we're changing policy at the moment in multiple countries because of the search and use and a lot of problems we see, but there's very little evidence to back that up, which is actually quite interesting and something we also see with cannabis research a lot now. So I think mostly just requesting like funding for nitrous oxide research in regular and heavy users, because it's important to focus on collecting that information to just be better informed. I think that's really, we're really at that stage only. We just need to gather more information now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Sammy, you were touching on before with the I guess the time spent on getting the substance, and with change in regulation this might change what we see in even that criteria, because like you said, really easily accessible, order online, get the canisters quite quickly, whereas if it's now illegal, at least in the UK, and it might take longer to get. Is there any talk of changing regulation in the Netherlands?
There is. I think since January 1st this year, so 2023, it's become illegal to sell or possess nitrous oxide for specifically for recreational purposes. The tricky part with this is that it's pretty hard to check the recreational purposes part. So I think it's become less common to sell the balloons, for example, on festivals, because that's just more regulated. But it's still being done, and it's still relatively easy to come by. There's also other laws that I think prohibit the selling to minors, or that limit the amount you can buy at the same time. But then again, still pretty much not an uncontrolled substance.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining on this podcast. And yeah, hopefully you will now read the paper. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Yes.